This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you, maybe right next door, right down the street. If you take the time to listen to some of those stories, you might be amazed, and your perspective on your own existence might change just a little bit. Each week, we visit with our veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, so often we're educated, we learn a lot, we're entertained, and even inspired by these members of our greatest generation, like 96-year-old Fred Stevenson of Porterville, California. If you served with him in the U.S. Army Air Corps, you probably called him Steve, but that was long ago and far away. And so was Great Falls, Montana, where you grew up as the fourth out of seven children, smack dab in the middle. Was that the best spot to be in that group of seven?
I don't know. In those days, we had to wear hand-me-down clothes, and some of the dresses didn't work very good on me.
Because you were fourth, but two of the ones ahead of you were girls, huh? Did they really try to get you to wear the girls' clothes?
No, I was just kidding. Although, you know, we lived on a ranch and raised chickens, and the sacks that the feed came in for chickens was made of cloth, and they made them out of cloth that it could be made into clothes. Right. And some of the clothes that was shirts I wore were made of cloth off of feed sacks. Yeah. They looked good, and my mother was a great seamstress, and so it worked out all right.
And little did she know that you'd be following in some of her sewing footsteps during World War II. There's so many different duties people had in World War II, and we've heard so many different perspectives on this show, but you're going to hear one today you haven't heard before. I want to continue to explore, though, your childhood there in Great Falls, Montana. The Great Depression hits in the early 1930s for you. You're entering your teenage years. What was that like during the Depression, and how did it impact your family?
We lived, like I say, on a little ranch, and my father worked as a foreman in repairing the streets of my hometown. But being a big family and the circumstances, we didn't have very much as far as luxuries are concerned. But we did have enough to eat, but it wasn't very varied. It was what was the cheapest in the store. It was a great life. We never went out to eat or anything at a restaurant. We had home-cooked meals and had a garden and so on. And in a chicken ranch, we had plenty of chicken for dinner. But other than that, it was nothing exceptional.
And how young were you when you had to start working to help support the family?
When I was just 13 or 14, I was working for a widow woman and cleaning up her yard and everything, and got a whole 35 cents a day and my lunch. I heard later on that she complained to the neighbors about how much I ate.
I think every veteran that I've interviewed who was in the U.S. Army Air Corps, whether he was a pilot or otherwise, just about every guy who got into the Army Air Corps did so because he wanted to be a pilot. And you had those aviation dreams from a pretty early age. How did that start?
I learned to fly when I was 18 in a little two-cylinder airplane that cost me $8 an hour for dual instruction. I was working on a dairy ranch during my vacation from school for $20 a month, and it was 14 hours a day and 6 hours off on Sunday. But I got through grade school. I wasn't intending on going to high school. But my dad was, he was smart in a lot of ways. When I was asked if I was going to high school, I said no. And my dad says, well, it's a good thing you won't go. You're too damn dumb to go anyway. So that made me mad, and I went to school just to spite him. And I graduated from high school.
Yeah, you graduated from high school in 1938. And as you said, at this point, you've already learned to fly. Was there an experience where you saw an airplane or you read about Charles Lindbergh or some other aviator and it said, yeah, that's what I want to do? How did you catch that bug? Because everybody says they caught that bug.
I was about 12 years old when I first seen an airplane. They weren't very common in those days. Once I seen that in the air, that made me say I want to be a pilot. Of course, under the conditions, I didn't have very much money, so it took me a long time to be able to even solo. And this little airplane was a two-cylinder plane, didn't take too much gas, so that's how I got my flying in. I knew I could never afford to go to a flying school. Only alternative was to join the Air Force and go into flying cadets. At that time, if you had a high school education, you were eligible for flying cadets. But after I joined to get in there, I had to join up for 3 years at the time, and I was assigned to the squadron, but it wasn't formed yet. And so I was sent out to a bombing range in the desert where Edwards Field is now, and I stayed there a year on detached service, they called it, until my outfit was formed. By that time, they decided that you had to have 2 years of college to be a flying cadet, and so that left me out. So the only thing I could do was get through my 3 years, and so they needed parachute riggers, so I was trained to be a parachute rigger.
It sounds a little bit like you got hoodwinked. You signed up thinking you're going to get to fly, then they changed the rules on you. Is that how you felt at the time? Were you upset when you heard that new rule?
Well, I was upset, but there was nothing I could do about it, and I had to stay in for my time. Well, sewing was part of parachute work and repairing and stuff, and I came acquainted with the sergeant that taught me how to fold chutes. And he became a good friend, and he said, do you want to get ahead in rank and in pay? And, of course, I did. And he says, well, there's a way of getting there by tests that they give every year, and if you are high scorer, they will give you rank and pay to go along with it. So he said, you've got a lot of time on your hands. He says, why not study, and I'll help you, and I'll give you a test once a week until the test is given. And under those circumstances, the first two qualifiers in the test were given rank and pay, and I got one of the two. I got put on flying status. If you'd go out and get a ride in an airplane, I went all over the West Coast in airplanes. Sometimes we was at altitudes, I never knew where we were at, but I was flying. So in about a month's time, I was from a PFC to a staff sergeant.
And when was it that you joined?
In September of 1940.
So a little more than a year later, December 7th, 1941, yeah. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. Where were you? How did you experience that world-changing day?
Packing parachutes, and one day two lieutenants came into our parachute deal and said, we're having a day when we're going to shut down the field and have like a circus or so. And they said that we needed somebody to jump a parachute, you know, for exhibition. And he said they figured as long as we were packing chutes, we ought to be able to get somebody to do it. So none of the eight guys that were packing parachutes opened their mouths, so I thought I'd be smart and say, well, you got to have special parachutes to jump exhibition. It has to be a larger chute than the regular chute, and then a spare chute for emergencies. And I says, we don't have any of those kind of chutes. The lieutenant says, if I get you one of those chutes, will you jump? So I was stuck. So I said, okay, I'll do it. I didn't think they could get the chute in the first place. And then a buddy of mine, he said, well, if you jump, I'll jump with you. So they said, well, we'll get you two chutes. And about 2 weeks later, here come two big boxes, and in them was the special chutes for us to jump. And so we practiced packing these special chutes and stuff, and it was getting close to the time when the show was going to take place when Pearl Harbor came along, and it saved me from jumping.
How many days away was your planned jump when that happened?
Oh, it was about a month from the time that Pearl Harbor happened and the show was to take place.
And you were still in the Mojave Desert at this time?
No, I was in Fresno.
So you're in Fresno, and the news comes across that the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. What did that do to the guys on the base there? What was it, a big deal? Was it chaos? Or what was happening?
Everybody started digging slit trenches around the barracks, and they shut down the field, and we were put on guard duty, shutting down the highways and stuff like that. And it happened to be kind of in the rainy season, and I stood out there in the rain for a while, and finally they needed somebody to man a machine gun on a Jeep. Well, my buddy had been in the infantry before he got in the Air Force, and so he knew how to operate a machine gun. He says, if you want to do it, he says, I'll give you a quick lessons in how to load a machine gun and get off a walking guard. So I says, okay, teach me. And so for about a month, I was manning a machine gun on a Jeep or patrolling the airbase. And then later on, they got regular guards to take over again.
So you described this, and in the immediate aftermath of this news that Japan has attacked America out on the Hawaiian Islands, the guys are really digging trenches around the base. Yes. You guys thought you might be under attack.
The B-24 bomber was just came into line, and one day there was a flight of B-24 bombers came in from L.A., and we hadn't seen them before, and we thought they were Japanese bombers. It really gave us a start there for until we found out they were our own planes.
Yeah, good thing you didn't shoot them down. So how long was it before you got sent elsewhere? Did you stay in Fresno for a while after that happened or no?
We stayed in Fresno for about a year, and then we were assigned to the 95th Bomb Group. So we went from Fresno to Walla Walla, Washington, and then from Walla Walla, we went to Sioux City, Iowa. And from Sioux City, we went to Rome, New York, which was a new airfield, and from then, we went overseas.
So this whole time, you're working with parachutes. What all were you doing with these parachutes? And I'm imagining most people have never seen or touched a World War II era parachute, let alone put one together or packed it.
I didn't know a thing about a parachute either until I was went to learn how to pack them. They had to be dried out every so often after they were in use. They had to be taken down and hung up in a loft to dry out. And at first, they had a deal that a parachute was, after being so old, had to be drop tested. Hammerfield or Fresno, when we first wasn't in operation, when I first seen Field, it was a bunch of weeds, and the runway wasn't even put in. We come in from March Field on a troop train and got out and marched across fields to get to our barracks, their new barracks. But it was quite a time before an airplane even landed in Fresno. So we used Chandler Field, and we first started drop testing chutes from Chandler Field. And I remember, of course, we were new at it, and we had a dummy to take place of a man, and we just threw him out of a cargo plane. The first one we drop tested, we had forgot to bring a rope for a static line, and so we came up with an old rope that was oil soaked and stuff, and tied it to the ripcord, and so that it would fall so far and then pull the ripcord out. But we made the mistake of not pulling the ripcord handle out of the pocket, and when it hit, it broke the rope, and the dummy and the chute fell down and hit the ground, popped up in the air about 10 feet, and then the chute opened. So that was our first experience in doing that.
And I'm imagining you're picturing that right now at home or in your car or wherever you're listening, the dummy slamming into the ground, bouncing up, and then suddenly deploying its parachute. There are a lot of things that Fred Stevenson saw in World War II that he had never seen before and hasn't seen since. And there's a lot more to his story. Before we're done, we'll hear how his ingenuity made a difference for airmen at his base in England, and also something that really changed Fred's perspective on life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 96-year-old Fred Stevenson of Porterville, California, originally from Great Falls, Montana. During World War II, he'd be stationed in Horam, England with the 95th Bomb Group. I know you joined the Army Air Corps because you wanted to fly, and you told us why it didn't work out that way and that you ended up in charge of packing parachutes. Did you come to enjoy that duty?
Oh, I enjoyed it. And sewing was part of the deal of taking care of parachutes. I had kind of a knack of sewing, and so I made different stuff, bags and stuff, sewing. Later on, when I got to England, after packing chutes for a while, they needed a sewing shop to fit flying clothes to the flying personnel. I don't know where they got the information, but I was picked to open this sewing shop. So they give me about five different other guys and about a dozen new sewing machines and a building and put me to work.
When was that you went across to England?
March in 1943. We went over in the Queen Elizabeth. And it was just overloaded. They put guys in there, there was even women in there, any place they could. In fact, there was so many on board that they couldn't all sleep at the same time. My outfit was down in the cargo holds, and we slept in hammocks. And they were so close together, they were practically touching. And Queen Elizabeth went by herself without escort, and depended upon her speed to keep away from the submarines, but they zigzagged the boat, and all the time, every time they'd get it level, they'd make another turn, and then our hammocks would start to turn, and they'd hit, and it was really a time. And then one of the big shafts that run the propellers went right through the cargo hold, and going at top speed, it just screamed, and we had that noise of all that screaming all the way for 5 days going over.
Yeah, that sounds like it's enough to drive you nuts. And, you know, most of the people, well, the people that I have on this show, we talk about war from an American perspective, and a lot of times we forget what the British people went through before America was ever involved in this war. But I bet when you got over there, you got a pretty palpable taste of what the Brits had been through.
Yes, we talked with a few of them, although where I was stationed in England was out in the farm area, and there was very few people around other than when we were on leave, going to London and stuff. And of course, that was quite an experience in itself.
Yeah, tell me about that. What did you see there, and were there some reasons to be concerned that you might be in danger?
Well, of course, they were still bombing London quite regularly there, but being young and new experience, we weren't really afraid. Although I was in a little hotel in London when the bombers came over, and we got kind of shook up, and it kind of brought to the fact that we were in a war. And then later on, we seen the buzz bombs from our base going over. And then later on, I was in London when a couple of the rockets hit, and that was really scary. Because the concussion of those things going off would kill people. There would be nothing wrong with them to look at them, but the concussion would kill them, and that was real scary.
So those were the V-2s?
Yes, they were V-2s.
How close were you to where they hit? What did you see?
It was, not real close, but we were within walking distance of where they hit, and seeing what happened to the people when they were subject to the concussions. And, of course, they did tremendous damage, too.
So you walk by and you see the damage that's done, and you see people scattered everywhere, just dead on the ground?
One time is the only time that I actually witnessed it, but it was enough to give me an impression that there was a war going on.
And what's to stop that from happening to you?
Well, like I say, we were young at that time. It didn't have a real bad impression on us.
Those of us who weren't born when all this was going on, we just understand World War II from history. We know who won, so it's hard for us to, I think, realize that you guys were in this war at a time where you didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know if your side was going to win. And I imagine being there in England, there were probably some days where you had significant doubts that the Allies were going to win.
Yes, at one time, the Germans were talking about invading England. And we had to keep a weapon with us as we went around our regular duties and stuff. And every once in a while, of course, we'd be strafed by German planes. And one time when we first got over there, our airfield wasn't ready for us, and we were put in another airfield in tents to wait the time to go. One morning, always way early in the morning, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, they had radio or loudspeakers in our tents, and here come across said that no one was to leave their tent under any circumstances until further notice. Of course, they didn't explain what was the matter. Time went by, and we got daylight, and we weren't supposed to leave. And it was about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning before we were allowed to leave. And come to find out, the Germans had dropped what they called anti-personnel bombs over our area, and they were little bombs that they would hit the ground and they would kind of open up. They called them butterfly bombs. And if you touched one of them walking, it would blow your leg off. Of course, they had to get a special crew of Englishmen to come in and defuse these bombs before we could leave our tents. But that was about the closest we came to being hurt.
And all this time, you're still pumping out these parachutes and checking them out all the time. How intense was that? Can you give us maybe the scope of that operation with the parachutes and what the significance of what you were doing was?
They had to be hung up and dried and every so often, and we weren't allowed to put our name like we did in the States of who packed them, but we just put a piece of paper with our initials on, and it was a great feeling. Every once in a while, some flyer would came in and say, whose initials are so-and-so? And, of course, at first we wouldn't know what they wanted, but then he'd say it worked, meaning that the parachute worked with our initials in it. Of course, we never did get anybody come in and say it didn't work.
I was going to say, the fact that he's there is proof that it worked well enough anyway. And, you know, again, just so we understand, this may seem very basic to you, but what was that whole process from start to finish with the parachutes? What steps did you have to go through to make sure that it was going to work and that these guys are in good hands?
There's a special routine of folding a chute, and we had long tables, and we strung them out there, and they had a certain way of folding them and putting them into the pack. And then the last thing was a little pilot chute that worked on a spring that you put in at the very last, and when you pulled the ripcord, this pilot chute would jump out and pull the big chute out of its pack. We had inspectors that checked the chutes on the guys that's packing them all the time, make sure that they never got lazy or didn't go through with them. But I was the inspector for quite a time before I was called to operate the sewing shop.
How much responsibility did you feel? Because really, if you don't do your job right, someone could die, right? I mean, that's not an exaggeration, is it?
I was, as an inspector, I was real strict. I wouldn't allow anything to get by me. And after you get the crew of packers under that idea, they knew better than try and pull something short. So we had no problem that way. Although one thing happened, when they flew the 17s over from the States over to England, and they went around about the way and went across jungles, so they put a what they call a jungle pack instead of the seat cushion on the seat chutes. And in case they forced down over jungles or someplace they had and got hurt, they would have some way of taking care of themselves. And in those was a little tube of narcotics. And when they got over to England, we took those jungle chutes off and dispensed the stuff and put a regular seat cushion on. We had to keep our parachute shop open 24 hours a day. And so different guys would take night duty. And then one time, one of the fellas said he volunteered to do the night duty, which was kind of a relief to us to stay up overnight. I came over to check something in the parachute department, and here I seen this guy sleeping, and his eyes were big and everything like that. Here he was using this dope that came off of these jungle packs, and he was having a good time until I caught him. So from that time on, we disposed of all that narcotics and stuff.
You know, I neglected to ask you about something. I think you had a lot of incentive to come back home from overseas because you got married right before you went over, didn't you?
On the way overseas, I said I went to Walla Walla first, and then I was stationed in Sioux City. A buddy of mine said, "Well, I'm going with a young lady. He says she's got a sister. Why don't you go with us on a double date?" And I said, "No, I don't want anything to do with that." But he kept talking, and so finally I broke down. So we went this just before Christmas. Here my girlfriend to be was a nurse, just fresh out of nursing school. As I walked in their house, she came down, there's a two-story house, came down the stairs, and it looked like she just got out of bed. She was, well, turned out that she was on night shift, taking care of patients, and here she hadn't had any sleep for the time we went. We really fell for each other, and 30 days later, we were married.
30 days. Were you hesitant at all? I mean, you know that you're going to be going overseas pretty soon. Did that?
I wasn't too crazy about getting married, but she insisted, so I went along with it. It was a gamble, you know, going overseas and war and going on, but it was worth it. I liked her well enough that I didn't want her to get away from me.
And while you were in England, you found out there was somebody else was going to be waiting for you?
That's right. She was pregnant, and in fact, she had joining the service as a nurse. Her papers hadn't gone through all the way yet. But when she found out she was pregnant, of course, that took care of that. And my son was 6-7 months old before I even found out I had a son. And it was a funny thing, the mail, even telegrams were hard to get through. The boy was born about a week or so before I even found out about it. And I got two telegrams the same day telling that I was a father of a son.
How did that feel? I imagine that's got to be bittersweet. I mean, it's good and bad at the same time, or somewhat difficult.
Of course, all my friends demanded they get a cigar, and I didn't smoke, so I went down and bought a box of cigars and handed them out. But I even tried to smoke one myself, but that didn't go over very well.
Was it ever a concern of yours that son might grow up without a father, that you might not make it back home?
No, we never thought of that. He always had the idea he was going to get back. Although the personnel that were lost, flying personnel from the bombing group I was at, was terrible. There was 10 men in each B-17. Sometimes we would send out 18 planes, and maybe 8 of them would come back. So there was a lot of guys, and we were subject to seeing that. And we got to the point where we didn't make friends with the flying personnel because they never lasted that long.
Yeah, that's just the way it was. It's not a fun thing to talk about, but that's the way it was. And I guess that, in a way, makes your job even more important. I mean, right, if there's that many planes being shot down, and some of those guys don't have a chance to bail out, but that's a lot of guys who are bailing out and need those parachutes to work.
Many times they never had a chance to bail out. The planes blew up and everything like that. It really hurt to see what was going on, the amount of young fellas that didn't come back from their flights.
Yeah, and when you consider that the 95th Bomb Group flew 334 missions between May of 1943 and May of 45, you can imagine how frequently those losses occurred. We're going to explore more of Fred Stevenson's World War II experiences when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting a new perspective on World War II today from a 96-year-old who had a unique role in the Army Air Corps. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to see photos of Fred Stevenson then and now, and even a look at a couple of his clever creations. Let's pick up where we left off, sir. What you said was that after a while, you learned not to make friends with anyone, but the way you learned that lesson was by losing guys that you knew.
The flying was in its infancy of long flights. The earphones they used were ones that just went over your head, and then the helmets went down over the earphones. The pressure of them helmets pushing on those earphones over a long flight were driving these flyers crazy from the pain. And so we came up with an idea of cutting holes in the helmets so that the biggest part of the earphone was on the outside. And then later on, the regular radio operators had a sponge deal that went on their earphones. We found out we could sew these sponge ones on the inside of their helmets, and that made it so they had no problem. But then the radio operators were mad at us because every time they laid down their earphones, they would lose the sponge rubbers because they were bringing them over to us to put in the helmets. One thing that was really amusing is a professional wrestler was one of the crew members or one of the gunners, and he had cauliflower ears. He came in to have something done because he couldn't stand it. He had to take his helmet off. So I fixed him up with a special deal with a sponge rubber and stuff like that. And he went on his first flight. When he came back, he was so happy that he grabbed me in a bear hug and just about killed me. He was so happy to have that pressure off these ears.
Well, and I can see that's still an emotional memory for you, just thinking about it now. And when you say we came up with the idea, so you're saying that you guys in the sewing shop had this idea that a change that you made affected pretty much everyone else who flew in that bomb group for the rest of the war?
I'm not going to take credit for that because I don't exactly remember how we ever got the idea. It might have been from somebody else seeing it and telling us about it or not.
But it was not, when you say we, you're not talking about the Army Air Corps. You're talking about you guys at that base.
The guys in my sewing shop. Although I did, on my own, make some masks to fit over the gunners in the waist gun position because they were exposed to the air at 30,000 feet at way below zero, and it'd freeze up their oxygen masks. By that time, they had come up with the electric heated suits. So I experimented taking a Navy mask and put electric heated wires in it and made it so that the fellas in the waist guns could wear them. I didn't make too many of them before I got an order from the 8th Air Force Headquarters, which was in High Wycombe, outside of London, to report and bring one of the masks with me. And so I went down there, and they looked it all over and everything and congratulated on me for trying to help out. But they said, we have our new oxygen masks have heaters built in them. And so they weren't really necessary anymore. But they kept the one that I brought with me and said they put it in some museum. I can't imagine really a relic by now.
So bright minds think alike, I guess. You just beat them to the punch with the one that that you jerry-rigged. Where do those ideas come from? I mean, did they just pop into your head that you've got a way to solve a problem no one else has solved?
They had what they call an Air Corps supply, is what they supplied the stuff to the flyers and stuff. And I knew the operator, or the head guy, and I was in his building, and I saw a pile of masks. They were white on one side and dark blue on the other. And I said, what are they? And he says, oh, it's a missed shipment. It must have went, there were Navy for the gunners on the battleships to wear. And he says, I have no use for them. And so I got the idea, maybe I could adapt some of those into masks. They went all over their face and had a skirt that went down over their chest. I says, can I have one? He says, you can take the whole bunch. He says, I have no use for them. So I took some of them and I experimented in my spare time. I stayed in my shop. I bunked in there and stuff to save guys having to come from the barracks to keep it open all the time. And so I had all this spare time, and so I took time out to experiment with these masks.
So you were basically on call any time, because if someone needs a chute or a mask or anything like that, they need it now.
We had to be open 24 hours a day. That way, living in my shop, I just took care of it.
What are some of the other items that you provided for the flyers or helped them with or improvised?
We had to fit the oxygen masks and fit their clothes and alter them to fit them and special. All guys aren't built the same. And
so you're a tailor, too.
That's right. And so with the change, with the loss of all this personnel casualties, we were kept busy all the time because there was always a bunch coming in.
Did that ever weigh on you when you realized how many guys are out there either getting killed or injured or taken prisoner?
Yes, it did. It looked like high school letting out when these guys came in, just young kids, and they had no idea what they were in for until after I had a flight or something. It was heartbreaking.
I can tell that you have great respect for the men who served in the Army Air Corps in World War II and carried out those missions that you were assisting them with this different equipment and clothing and everything. I know it's hard to describe a group of thousands, but how do you remember those guys as a whole, the people that served in the Air Corps at your base during World War II?
I had a lot of respect for them. They actually, the young ones didn't know what they were getting into, and then seeing them after their first couple of flights, it was a real experience. And then they'd have to have three or four flights before they actually got to know what was the whole deal was about. And some of them were real brave about it, and some of them were pretty worried about every flight. And there were some, I think, even actually enjoyed it. I don't know. But it was really experience on my part just to see the guys going through my shop.
You're talking about the invasion of Normandy in June of 44, and most people think about the guys hitting the beach. They forget about all the paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines and all the bombers that were in the sky. What was your perspective on that, and how did you see that play out at your base?
Well, of course, our base was real busy during the invasion. They were one flight after another going out all day long. And then the weather wasn't too good for us. They had a lot of low clouds and stuff, and some of the planes that went up couldn't find their own base, and they were landing at ours, and it was a real mix-up. I couldn't do anything but feel sorry for the guys involved in that invasion, because everything was against them.
One of the reasons I've come across the base where you were before is I knew a man whose American plane was shot down between one base and another because the Germans had planes that would come over the English coast at night and shoot him down. Did you know that was happening? Did you know that the German fighters were in the air?
Yeah. In that our area, they had searchlights and night fighters. You could go out practically any time the weather was halfway good, and you would see these searchlights, and they'd be four or five searchlights converge in one spot, and you'd watch in that spot, and you'd see a burst of flame, and it was the German planes that got into that spotlight, and those guys on those spotlights were good enough that once he got in that cross, he didn't get out of it, and the fighter planes would just come and shoot where that lights crossed. And they'd get the invader.
Who needs the movies when you can go outside and watch that show, huh?
That's right. But it got give you an idea of what was going on. It wasn't all fun and games.
Did you ever have any famous folks or big shots visit your base?
Oh, yes. We had some of the top guys. And then Glenn Miller and his orchestra played at our base when I think it was our 100th mission. We closed down the base and had a party, and they had Glenn Miller and his band playing at the base. That was a strange thing that Glenn Miller was lost flying over the North Sea, and there was a whole bunch of different rumors of what happened, and I never did really hear what actually was the cause of the plane going down.
And that must have been not too long after he played that concert for you. Did that make you kind of feel good? Because, I mean, you guys all knew who Glenn Miller was back in the States. Did it make you wish your wife was there to dance a string of pearls with her, or what?
It was a wild party. I don't know whether I'd wished anybody really close to me to be at it, but they sent special trains from London with women to entertain us. I never did go into the party myself, but they really had some times there, getting rid of the women after they were supposed to go home.
Well, speaking of going home, you got to go home, see your wife again, and meet your son for the first time. Tell me about that. How did that happen, and what did that feel like?
Well, he had been with his mother, and she lived with her folks, and my son had been with women all the time, and here comes this guy grabbing him and hugging him, and he didn't want nothing to do with me. In fact, it was a real kind of a heartache to try to even get close to him, and he's a redhead, and he had a temper. It took a while for him to get used to me being around.
That had to be hard for you. I mean, here you're looking forward to this whole time, and he doesn't know who you are.
Yes. In fact, after I got her to come to Fresno, everything was packed, hotels or everything was packed for personnel. You couldn't find a place to stay, and I ended up in a hotel that the railroad fellas used at the end of their run to go back, and it was a rundown motel. You didn't even have a bathroom in the room. You had a bathroom in the hall, and my son didn't want me in in close to him when he slept. And, of course, the room only had one bed. We ended up by sleeping on the floor and the son sleeping in the bed.
Yeah, that's the price that you paid coming home from World War II. I do want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us about it. What do you think is important for the rest of us? I mean, you have kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, even a great-great-grandchild. All these folks who weren't alive in World War II, what do we need to know about all of those of you who were and who fought that war and won that war?
Well, I don't want to get started in on that, but what I think is World War II that I was in was actually the last war that we actually won. And all the wars have been negotiated and stuff like that, and we always seem to come off the short end. I'm thinking that we ought to turn around and start winning wars instead of negotiating the ends of them.
What are you most proud of with regard to your own service in the war?
I'm real proud of Harry Truman, that he had guts enough to use the atomic bomb in Japan. It saved thousands and thousands of our men's lives the way he did it. And I don't think there's a guy in Washington that has the guts enough to do what he did.
With regard to your specific involvement, all those parachutes you packed, the masks that you fixed for people, the adjustments you made to headsets to make it so they could actually fly and not feel like their head was in a vice grip. Do you take some satisfaction in that? Do you feel like you made a contribution?
I feel I did my part, but I don't think I'm any hero. These people that are saying, oh, you're a hero or something like that, I was just doing a job, and I don't look at it as anything different than that.
Who are the heroes in your mind?
The fellows are actually doing the flying, and they're subject to going up in those airplanes and taking the brunt of the war.
Now, I saw in this great article you have from the 95th Bomb Group newsletter, you peeking out. Was that just a photo op, or did you get that bird up in the sky?
No, I never flew when I was over in England, but of course I wanted to get a picture in one of the airplanes. In fact, that particular airplane was a famous airplane. It was one that was flown from the States over to England. It did a real good job of bombing and everything. I think that was the same airplane. They became war-weary. They stripped the armament out of it and used it for transferring parts from the depot to our air bases. I think that was the plane that they were taking the fellas back to rest in Scotland that crashed, that I wasn't was supposed to be aboard.
Wait a second. There's a story here. You were supposed to be aboard a plane that went down and killed all the guys on board?
Right. I got to know a first lieutenant that was one of the pilots. We became good friends. In fact, his last name was Witt. He was from Texas. We got to the point where we kidded each other and stuff, and I called him Nit because his last name was Witt, and we got big kick out of him. Well, he was the pilot of a plane that was taking these war-weary flyers to a rest deal in Scotland. Him knowing that I had relatives in Scotland, he said, well, why don't you come along with me? And we'll take them up there and be our 3 days, and we'll come back. Well, I said, well, how can you stay with me for 3 days when you're supposed to come back? And he says, well, they have a crew chief on this plane. And he says, if I tell that crew chief there's something wrong with the plane and it takes him 3 days to fix it, we'll be there. So anyway, he says, we're going to take off tomorrow morning real early. But if you can get a pass and go, I'll make you my co-pilot. But early in the morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call in my shop, and it was him on the phone, and he says, you know, they run a whole bunch more guys in the bunch that I'm taking up there this flight, and he says, I don't have room for you. So I said, well, that's all right. We'll do it some other time. And he says, I'll make a point of that. Well, they took off at daybreak, and about an hour or so later, I got a phone call saying the plane had crashed and every one of them was cremated.
I can't imagine what that felt like. Do you remember? How do you react to news like that?
I tell you, I wasn't a Christian before that, although my wife, my family were. But when I thought of there's somebody up there watching over me, I better get to it. And I did.
Right then.
That's right. So I've been a Christian ever since.
You're 96 years old now, but people can hear how with it you are, how sharp your memory is. What's your secret? What keeps you going?
I really don't know. I just think I'm too ornery for the devil to take me and too ornery for the Lord to take me too. So I'm just waiting for them to make up their mind.
Well, we're all happy that hasn't happened yet. Fred Stevenson of Porterville, California. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.